time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for April 6th, 2019. What a show it is. We have three guests and three topics. And first, it's a controversy. Everyone loves a good he said, she said, only in this case, it's WaveCell versus MIPS helmet technology. On March 19th, Matt Phillips published the following headline in Bicycling Magazine. Quote, Bontrager says its new helmets can prevent concussions 99 out of 100 times, end quote. It didn't take too long for those who developed the MIPS technology to refute Bontrager's claims, citing an inability to replicate the testing. Reading the article reminds me so much of just how the bike industry makes its claims. One company reports its sales in dollars, while another reports its sales in units. And the same is true in this article. Case in point, the article states that the company says that a helmet with WaveCell will prevent a concussion 99 times out of 100. A standard foam helmet, for comparison, can only prevent a concussion 42% of the time. See what I mean? So rather than trying to sort it all out myself, I turned to freelance journalist Joe Lindsay. Joe breaks down the controversy and puts some thoughtful ideas in what you might do if your head does hit the ground. In his April 2nd article for Outside Online titled, Trex Wave Cell Technology is Causing Controversy. Joe always does his homework, and it's true in this case. He'll be my first guest. Then we'll head out to L.A. to speak with Larry Pizzi, the president of Accel North America. The last time we spoke with him was back in 2013. He was still with iZip, an electric bike brand, and today, while iZip is still a brand in the stable of Accel, Larry oversees several other brands, as well as the entire Accel North America company. Today, we talk about how e-bikes are faring in the world of cycling, their growth, who is riding them, and how regulations around the use of e-bikes is being developed and implemented. Finally, it's a discussion with one of the number one bike fitters in the country, if not on the planet. Soft-spoken and serious, Happy Friedman has decades of experience coupled with the use of the Leon Root MD Motion Analysis Lab, a state-of-the-art testing facility at the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York City. Yet with all the fancy-schmancy equipment at his disposal, Happy has a straightforward and relatively simple way of making the adjustments needed, and they aren't what you might think. So first, it's off to Boulder, Colorado, to talk helmet technology with journalist Joe Lindsay. Hi, Joe. Welcome back to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Always a pleasure.
Here we go. Helmet technology. This week, you published an article in Outside Online, Trex WaveCell Helmet Technology is Causing Controversy. And they came out with some outrageous claim at the very beginning, and they backed off a little bit. But let's talk about your article and what WaveCell helmets are and then what the controversy is all about.
So WaveCell is basically a new helmet technology for managing impacts. And it's different than what's out there. What it is is basically a very low-density lattice-like structure in plastic. And that structure is designed in an impact to not just compress and absorb the energy of the impact, but also to shear. And so what that allows it to do is handle the sort of the linear impacts that conventional EPS foam handles, but also the rotational energy that we sort of come to understand is very important in crashes in terms of head injuries like concussions.
One of the questions I have about the WaveCell helmet, which is coming out under the Trek banner, is the weight. Does the WaveCell liner weigh a lot more, or is it light?
No, it's reasonably light. I haven't weighed the helmets just yet, but my the WaveCell basically replaces some of the EPS foam in a conventional helmet design. There is still a liner of EPS foam and, of course, the plastic outer shell. But the WaveCell does replace that, and theoretically, because it is this like very open lattice structure, it's going to be fairly light. I haven't seen anything to suggest that weight is necessarily a big issue.
Okay. The big controversy is WaveCell truly 48 times better at preventing concussions? And so far, the jury might still be out on that, as opposed to MIPS. So they're both claiming the same thing, that they're helping with the rotational issue of the brain rotating in the helmet upon impact, causing concussion. So what is MIPS saying?
Well, MIPS says the 48 times more effective claim is interesting because in the small print, Trek makes it clear that that is when tested against a conventional EPS foam-only helmet, something that doesn't have a rotational energy system like MIPS in it. The differences to MIPS are still in their testing, are still there, but it's quite a bit less. It's, you know, I think they said something like 34% of instances there was a risk of brain injury for MIPS versus only 1.2% for the WaveCell stuff. So it's an interesting claim, but their headline claim doesn't really directly address what MIPS does. And so that comes down to the whole issue of rotational energy, which, again, it seems like is one of the major, if not the deciding factor in closed head injuries.
Right. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Joe Lindsay. He's written an article about Trek's new WaveCell helmet technology. It is causing controversy. There are other technologies that do the same type of thing, help to prevent or help, well, they don't actually 100% prevent that rotational impact problem, but they are better than, of course, perhaps the old helmets. And I guess we can prove that. And that's really what I want to talk about is testing a little bit. You know, it used to be you'd drop a helmet at a specific height onto some concrete type thing. And if it didn't crack and break, it got a sticker. And we said, okay, all helmets pretty much passed that test. Now we have technologies we don't necessarily understand and that have equal testing. So what are your thoughts about that?
Well, there's a couple of issues here, and one of them is that MIPS obviously came out with its testing and said that it had tested the WaveCell helmets and that it was not able to replicate the results that Trek got. And Trek's results, I should point out, were published in a peer-reviewed journal, the Accident and Analysis Prevention, I think. And that's a peer-reviewed journal, and that's not necessarily a guarantee of accuracy or validity or anything like that, but it is worth something. But there were some differences in their methodologies. They both tested the WaveCell helmets and EPS foam-only helmets in these drop situations on basically at various drop speeds against an angled anvil. And the angled anvil, as opposed to a flat anvil, is supposed to be what introduces these rotational energy elements into the situation. The difference between the tests is that the researchers that Trek worked with, who are also the ones who invented the WaveCell technology, they tested using a helmet and a head form inside the helmet that was attached to what's called a flexible dummy neck. And that dummy neck is designed to basically approximate how the head reacts in a crash, that the head is not rigidly attached to the body, nor is it free-floating in space. But that's a non-standard test methodology. It's not used in any of the sort of national regulatory certification test protocols around the world, nor does Virginia Tech use it in their testing. What we see in that testing is for, like the American, the CPSC standard, the helmet and head form are rigidly attached. So when the helmet hits that anvil, there's no movement of the head on the helmet. All the rotational energy is transferred strictly through. Whereas the Virginia Tech and the European standards, the helmet and the weighted head form inside are basically dropped from a free fall. They're not attached to anything. They're just at the end of a rope. And so the helmet and the head are free to spin when they hit that anvil. So the WaveCell guys tested with this flexible head form and neck form. The MIPS folks tested without it, with just a free fall. And so there's some differences there in how they tested that make me wonder if that is somehow responsible for the fact that they came up with vastly different results out of this. But then that leads to sort of the broader question that there's no rotational energy standard at all in any sort of helmet testing certification. And what's even more interesting is that at this point, I'm not really aware of a big push to change that.
Yeah, that is interesting. Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Joe Lindsay. We're talking about helmets and the testing for safety. And that kind of brings up a question that takes me over to the NFL. So much money is being thrown at this idea of concussions in football and bringing it back down to kids too. And it seems to me that we in the bicycle industry might take something away from that. Where can we go to get equal testing? I mean, it used to be CPSC. Somebody monitored those tests. Why are we allowing so many different possible testings right now?
Yeah, so basically there's a number of testing standards around the world. In the U.S., we have the CPSC. And then in Europe, there's a standard called EN1078 that basically covers the entire European Union. Down in Australia and New Zealand, there's the ASNZS testing. And the interesting thing about these tests is that, with the exception of the Australia and New Zealand one, they mostly haven't been updated in at least 15 years. The CPSC regime basically replaced the old ANSI standard in about 1999. And there are still some voluntary standards as well, like the Snell B90 or B95. But again, most of those haven't been updated in close to 20 years. And this is long before we started thinking about rotational energy. The first product that had a MIPS liner in it was a POC ski helmet, snow sports helmet, in about 2005. And that's really when we started to look at the whole role of rotational energy in head injuries. And the idea there being that even in a case where the skull doesn't fracture, that when you crash and hit your head, your head twists sort of violently from side to side, and yet the brain that's suspended inside the skull in this layer of fluid has a sort of delayed reaction to that. So the head twists really hard and fast, and then the brain twists, you know, milliseconds later, twists on its own, and that sort of sloshing is what's responsible for bruising and tearing of those tissues. That's where we start to think about rotational energy. And that's something that none of the helmet sort of testing certification standards, even the Australia and New Zealand one, have really gotten around to updating. And so what we're doing now is testing helmets that like MIP, that have MIPS, or that have WaveCell, and we're testing them strictly on a linear impact standard. Like, we're sort of ignoring the role that MIPS, for example, plays. The MIPS liners only address rotational energy. They don't do anything about the linear sort of impact and compression and all of that. And so in that gap now, you see organizations like Virginia Tech that is starting to do impact testing on bicycle helmets, as you mentioned, not football helmets. I think that's where a lot of this comes. The Virginia Tech ratings in particular are really interesting because they are looking at the whole role of rotational energy as well as linear impact velocity. And so that's something that I think has a lot to offer, but I think it's really interesting that that's coming from a university research institute rather than from consumer safety commissions.
Yeah, it is interesting. So the last thing that you talk about in your article, which I think is probably the place where we really need to focus, and that is, what's the consumer to think? What is he or she to do? Is it time for a new helmet? And if so, what's the right helmet? And there are no answers, it seems. But you had some really interesting things to say about that.
Yeah, so I think one of the things is that I think that consumers, because of the way that testing certification has worked for so long, consumers have a little bit of a misunderstanding about how this works. You know, as we talked about, like, you know, you put the helmet through the CPSC testing protocol, for example, and either it passes or it fails. And so whether it's a $300 helmet or a $30 helmet, it passes or fails. And people get the idea that those helmets are equally safe. And that's not really the case. And the helmet companies themselves are often either reluctant to say or feel that legally they cannot say that a helmet is safer than another. And I think that's partly where Trek's claims ruffled so many feathers. They're the first company that I've seen to really step out of that and sort of qualitatively assess not just that this helmet passes these, you know, these recommendations, but that it's safer than the other helmets out there. And I think that's sort of what started this fight. And that's where the Virginia Tech stuff comes in that's so interesting, is because this is the first time that I've seen an organization, and in this case, an objective independent organization, test helmets and sort of qualitatively rank them. So if you go to the Virginia Tech helmet ratings page, you'll see that the top three helmets are all Bontragers.
Right.
And two of them are Wavecell, and one of them is a MIPS helmet, which is that sort of tends to put Trek and Bontragers claims under a little bit more scrutiny. They're all ranked as 5 stars, which is the best rating that Virginia Tech offers. And the cumulative score in this case is all very close. But what's interesting there is that those helmets are scored. A lower score is better. It's like golf. And you can see that the score for the Bontrager Spectre Wavecell is a 10.8. The Bontrager Ballista MIPS is a 10.9. And then the Bontrager XXX Wavecell is an 11.8. So you're going up a little bit. They're still all 5-star, but you can sort of see, you can take helmets and sort of look at them and be like, this one actually had the best scores, objectively, the best scores in this testing. Not just that it passes, but how well it passes, how well it manages that energy. And I think that is the kind of thing that I think is really adding something qualitatively, sort of fundamentally worthwhile to this discussion, is the idea that not all helmets that passed, you know, that passed CPSC or EN 1078 certification are necessarily created equal. And so, yeah, the recommendations that I have right now is that Virginia Tech has some of the most credible testing out there. I haven't seen any evidence, any company or expert come forward to sort of criticize their methodology and protocols. They are independent because they're a university research center. Obviously, they rely on funding, but they're not specifically tied to Bontrager or Giro or Bell or anybody like that. You know, they sort of transparently list their test protocols and their results. If you pick a helmet that's rated 4 stars or better from Virginia Tech, you're probably, in terms of what a helmet can do for you, this is about as good as it gets.
We did a piece on the Virginia Tech testing, and at the time there was no Wavecell. So they are continuing to test helmets, which is good. I guess the most important thing we can tell listeners is to, you know, make sure that if you do fall and hit your head, one of the things you say right away is get medical attention, regardless of what you think, you know, and how you think you feel.
The point I pulled out of that is really related to some of the stories that we've heard from some prominent cyclists over the past few years about the impact of head injuries on their overall health. Just last week, Bicycling ran an article written by former editor-in-chief Leah Flickinger that detailed 6 cyclists' experiences with depression. And what I thought was notable about that story, other than the really courageous honesty that all of those athletes showed, was that in a number of instances, the problems that developed seemed like they started to happen after a crash where they had a head injury. And that's interesting because we have known for some time that head injuries are fairly strongly linked to an onset of depression afterward, and that they can be accompanied with personality changes and cognition changes that are chronic, long-term issues. And this is something that I think we used to take very lightly. We would laugh about, you know, somebody getting their bell wrong and that kind of thing. And I think we're really finally starting to realize the severity, the long-term severity of these kinds of injuries. Bicycle helmets were never designed to protect against all kinds of impacts. They're simply not built and not tested at impact speeds that, you know, that you might sustain in a crash on your bicycle, in particular if you are hit by a car. And so if you are hit by a car, if you do crash and you do hit your head, then yes, absolutely seek medical attention. And as you do seek medical attention, emphasize as strongly as you can the head injury part of it. You may be focused on other injuries that you have, road rash or, you know, broken bones or things like that, God forbid. And the medical staff may focus on that as well. But you should be absolutely, as to the extent possible after having a head injury, absolutely focused on making sure that head injury gets checked out and that you get the kind of care and recommendations that requires.
Excellent advice. Well, as always, I appreciate how much you look into these matters and how you relay them to the general public. And it's always wonderful to talk with you because you are so clear and concise. Once again, we've been talking with Joe Lindsay. He is a freelance journalist. This time he wrote a great article. If you're interested in seeing it, it is an Outside Online. The article is titled "Trex Wave Cell Helmet Technology is Causing Controversy." Thanks so much, Joe. What are you working on now?
Let's see here. So I have, I think last time we talked, I was working on a story about Dario Pegoretti and his death and what happens to the frame shop afterward.
Right.
That is nearing completion.
Oh, good.
I just published a piece for Wired about digital integration in bicycle technology with the rise of things like Fox's Live Valve and SRAM's new Access wireless protocol and things like that.
Interesting.
I published a piece for Bicycling on Zwift and the massive round of investment that it got in December and what its plans are for that money, including their sort of big plans around e-racing and the KISS Super League. So all kinds of fun stuff.
Yeah, it sounds like you are busy. Well, thanks for taking time out to talk with me.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Take care. Joe Lindsay joined me from his office in Boulder, Colorado. If you are interested in his article about Bontrager's Wave Cell Technology helmet and the controversy surrounding its claims to fame, you can log on to OutsideOnline.com and search for Joe Lindsay. So let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk e-bikes with Axel NA's president, Larry Peasy. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We're back. I'm Diane Jenks, and you're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. I've known Larry Peasy for a very long time. His roots are in bicycle retail, and over the past several decades, he's taken his retail experience and moved them into the supply side of our industry. Today, he's president of Axel Group NA, representing some of the most popular electric assist bikes in the world, among other bicycle products. Here's his take on the e-bike market today. Hello, Larry. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. It's been 6 years since we last spoke.
Wow, that really makes me feel old, Diane.
Well, we won't go there. We won't go there.
But seems like yesterday.
It does seem like it. And yet, I looked back at when we had our last conversation, and it was indeed 6 years ago. So you are on the West Coast right now.
I am. I'm in L.A. today.
Yeah, Mr. East Coast guy, because I know you're originally from Philly, aren't you?
I am. And actually, we just moved the family back to Maryland. I've been sort of doing a bi-coastal commute.
Wow. Because, I'm from Philly originally, too. So
I could hear it in your voice.
Yeah. So people have said, although it's been a long time. Well, let's talk about e-bikes, since that's what this is all about. You know, I've noticed technology changing, acceptance of e-bikes has changed some. What would you say the state of the e-bike market is today, just in general?
Well, it's, it is the fastest growing category in cycling in North America today.
Wow.
So it's changed really dramatically in the last 6 years since we've been in touch. And, my friends and acquaintances from the industry no longer roll their eyes when I say the word e-bike. So it's a real positive thing from my perspective. You know, what I really love about it is that it makes cycling accessible for everyone. Those that haven't ridden a bike in a long time, or those that have always felt that cycling was too much of an athletic pursuit. And it really levels the playing field, enables people to ride together, and I think it's a total game changer for our industry.
Looking at the U.S. market, how is it compared to the overseas market, which I think is maybe even bigger?
Oh, yeah. Western Europe is much more developed. The category went mainstream in the Netherlands in 2006.
Wow.
Mainstream meaning about 15% of the total revenue in the market. We're not there yet in the States. You know, the good data that we have really focuses on the U.S. IBD sector and also sort of rest of market, meaning those online retailers that report their data to NPD. But as at the end of 2018, it was about 10% of total revenue in the cycling category. And clearly the fastest growing sector 3 years in a row, I believe. And, you know, we're in a market environment in U.S. bicycle retail today where most other categories are in decline, unfortunately. And, you know, when you compare it to Europe, and we look to the Netherlands where it really all started on the back of an Excel brand called Sparta, it is also growing there year over year. And just in 2018, the sale of electrically assisted bikes eclipsed the unit sales of non-electric bikes for the first time in 2018. So, you know, we have, you know, significant numbers of years in Europe where the category continues to grow. And not only in the Netherlands, where I think people have little bike DNA floating around in their bodies. And they use bikes for transportation, obviously, a lot. And it's not necessarily where we are in the States today, although that is changing also. Other countries in Europe where cycling is more sport and recreation, more similar to, you know, to the U.S., e-bikes are also making considerable strides. And Germany, which is the largest single marketplace for bikes, e-bikes are dominant. When I go into retail stores in Europe, when I visit, e-bikes are front and center at every store. And when you talk to the retailers about e-bikes, they don't know what their businesses would look like if they weren't selling e-bikes. They're, you know, as I said, everything else is in decline there as well.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Larry Pizzi. He is president of XLNA North America. And we're talking about electric bikes, if you haven't figured it out, e-bikes. That brings me to a question about who is selling electric bikes, because I think auto manufacturers are getting into electric bikes, Uber and Lyft, your services. Where does the traditional brick and mortar bike dealer fit in? And if it doesn't go there, is that a problem for the industry?
Well, everybody's getting into the category. And, you know, we're seeing a dynamic change in the way people are getting around, especially in crowded urban centers. You know, micro-mobility is booming, and e-bikes are certainly a big part of that and probably the safest part of that from a user experience perspective. U.S. IBDs are rapidly adapting the category. I mean, there's still some outliers that just don't see the opportunity or just don't feel like it tugs at their heartstrings from, you know, a passion perspective and are not in the e-bike business. But the most recent study that I've seen shows that about 75% of U.S. IBD retail doors are stocking e-bikes. Pretty much all of the major brands are in the category. And like I said, because it's the fastest growing category, I think most people are doubling down on the growth opportunity it presents.
Well, it's interesting. When I think back over the years I was in retail, and I think back to a guy named Ed Benjamin, who I know you know, he was so sure this was going to happen. And it was probably 30 years ago that he was talking about this. And, you know, it's the overnight sensation that took 30 years, just like so many things, so many things. It's so interesting that it is actually happening. So I wanted to ask you about some of the legal issues around pedal assist and e-bikes. And when we have a lot of people riding bike paths, pedal assist bikes can only go X number of miles per hour. I think there are classifications of them. So are there laws that have to change or that are being made to accommodate e-bikes?
Yeah, that's a great question. So you may know that I chair the Bicycle Product Suppliers Association e-bike committee.
Okay.
And for the last, this is our fifth year where I've been raising money from the industry to fund a legal and legislative effort. We work really closely with People for Bikes on getting this legal and legislative work done. 5 years ago, we floated model legislation in the state of California that classify low-speed electric bikes, which is how the federal government and the CPSC describe, put sort of guardrails around the definition of an e-bike. We decided that it was too broad of a description to get regulatory changes done where use is determined. And that's, of course, at the state level. And it's a state-by-state pursuit. So we created a three-class system for low-speed electric bikes. Class one bikes are pedal assist only with a top motorized speed of 20 miles an hour. And that means that the assist cuts off when the bike reaches 20 miles an hour. And class two is in essence the same thing, except it's a bike that has a throttle, which means that a throttle can, you know, override any pedal assist functionality, and you can ride it like a scooter. And it also has to, speed has to cut off when the bike reaches 20 miles an hour. And then class three is what we call a speed bike, and that's a pedal assist bike that has a higher top speed that cuts off when the bike reaches 45 kilometers an hour, which is 28 miles an hour. And that is parallel to the European standard for what they call speed pedal X in Europe. And that sets the class structure. And what that enables municipalities and local enforcement to do is to appropriately regulate use of these different types of low-speed electric bikes. For example, a class one bike that's pedal assist only has about the same impact on a natural surface trail as a normal, you know, mountain bike would have. A throttle on a bike on a natural surface trail would allow the rear wheel to spin out and cause sort of environmental impact, which, you know, of course we don't want. Class two is regulated, you know, primarily for pavement use, and people generally don't have any objection to a class two bike sharing normal bicycle infrastructure. And class three, most people feel like 28 miles an hour is too fast on, you know, sort of separated bike infrastructure, but most people don't have any objections to, you know, a bike going 28 miles an hour if it's in a roadway or it's in a bike lane that is adjacent to a roadway. And, you know, what we're finding is that that's a class of e-bikes that a lot of cyclists are adapting as an alternative to getting in their car to commute, which is a wonderful thing.
Yeah, it really is a wonderful thing. Are you getting any government or municipal pushback about e-bikes using just the roadway in places, especially where there is no bicycle infrastructure?
Well, generally speaking, when there is not clarity of understanding of what these vehicles are all about, we get pushback. So, you know, our approach is to partner with local business in each state that we try to get the bill passed, and local bicycle advocacy organizations that, you know, have some experience with e-bikes, realize that they are just making cycling more accessible to larger numbers of people. And when we can get in front of the lawmakers and the decision makers that weigh in on the passage of these bills, and they actually experience what an e-bike is like, most of them conclude that it's really pretty similar to a bicycle. And then the problems tend to fade away. As of today, as we're sitting here today on April, what is it, today the 5th, we have the three-class bill passed in 15 states, and we have probably six or seven more that are in process in this legislative session. This year, in 2019, we are seeing the fastest adoption of our three-class bill on a state-by-state basis because, you know, people are out there buying and riding e-bikes, and the micro-mobility trend with, you know, as you mentioned, Uber and Lyft are, you know, beginning to deploy e-bikes in their share fleets. Local lawmakers have to, you know, they're contending with e-bikes, and, you know, they look to our bill as being very successful in terms of how they're appropriately regulated for use in the states that have adopted them so far.
Something just occurred to me about age limits, and not to the upper end, but to the lower end. Is there any issue with young people riding these pedal assist bikes?
Well, there isn't, with the exception of class three.
Okay. Which, sure.
In our model legislation, we have 16 years of age as a requirement for class three. Some states adopt that and some states don't. For the most part, we put it out there because we think, you know, a vehicle that's traveling at that rate of speed should have an experienced rider aboard.
Sure, sure. This is all fascinating. I you know, now it occurs to me, why wouldn't you get into this, especially as you want to move people away from their automobiles and into something where they can use a bicycle again for transportation. But if you look into your Larry's crystal ball, what does the bicycle industry look like going down the road, maybe 5 years from now? What do you think?
Well, I think we're going to see these things continue to proliferate. And, you know, I think we'll see the integration of motors and batteries in a way that, you know, will be almost indistinguishable between a pedal bike, a non-electric bike, and an electric assist bike. I believe that conventional bicycles, non-electric bikes, they're not going away anytime soon.
Right.
I think there will always be a desire for sport, fitness, and, you know, even normal recreational use for recreation and exercise. I don't see non-electric bikes disappearing from our landscape by any means. However, what my hope and desire is that e-bikes bring many more people into cycling as an activity and increase the amount of use that people, you know, cycle. And so more frequent use and adding to the population of cyclists across, you know, across North America. It certainly has been the case in Europe and, you know, Asia is, China in particular, they have, you know, they've exploded, but the product is quite different. So, you know, when we think about Western civilizations and how they use bicycles, Europe is probably the best parallel, and it keeps growing year over year. I don't see it stopping anytime soon.
Well, on that note, we should not take six more years to talk about this again. We should probably do this more often. Fascinating conversation. I've been speaking with Larry Pizzi. He is the president of Accel. One of their e-brands is Raleigh. Do you have more than one e-brand? Because I can remember going all the way back to Curry and iZip and all those things with you.
Yeah. Well, so iZip is in our portfolio, and it's focused at both as an omni-channel brand. It's available for sale online. And then we have a e-performance brand, a German brand called HiBike, which we've been selling in North America for the last 5 or 6 years. So we have a pretty complete portfolio of e-bike brands under Raleigh, iZip, and HiBike.
Well, Larry, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today. It's been a fascinating conversation. I hope you have a great 2019 selling season, and we'll talk again.
Thanks, Diane.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Larry Pizzi is president of Accel Group NA. If you're interested in knowing more about the company and its brands, you can log on to www.accel-group.com. So let's take another short break, and when we come back, it's off to New York City for a conversation about bike fit with pro fitter Happy Friedman. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. My first question with pro bike fitter Happy Friedman was asking why bike fit is so important. His answer is simple, and it's off to the races from there. Hi, Happy. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I know you've expanded, updated, and in some ways simplified bike fitting techniques, and everybody knows I love to talk about bike fitting. So I want to start with just a basic question about bike fit. Why is it so important?
Well, if you're a cyclist and you want to be efficient and comfortable on your bike, it's worth the investment in time.
Okay, that's about as simple as it gets. That works.
But you can put layers and layers. Like an onion.
Sure. One of the cool things about where you work, which is the Hospital for Special Surgery in Manhattan, is all the tools that you have at your disposal. And I've seen pictures of your workspace, and it's got some really cool stuff. Tell us the kinds of tools you're using to facilitate your fittings, and then we'll talk about your sort of technique.
Well, if necessary, we can go the full medical route, starting with MRIs, x-rays, down to motion capture, force plates. But I tend to go much lighter than that. I'm using a trainer, one of several, depending on the bikes that the person shows up with, using a laser or two to illustrate tracking of the knees. I have a pulse oximeter, which I use frequently to look at blood flow and oxygen saturation. I have a spirometer, which I use very infrequently, which tells you the volume of air going in and out of the lungs, as well as velocity. And I have a plum, which I keep just for old time's sake.
Yeah, right, exactly.
As well as a goniop, which is handy for swatting flies.
Must really smash those flies. Those things aren't light. That's funny.
So those are my basic tools.
How many times does somebody come to you and you find that they have the wrong bike?
It's probably about 20% of the time.
Okay.
That people have the wrong bike. But they may have had the wrong bike for the last 40 years.
Interesting.
Or it may have been the right bike at one point, but their needs and their activities have changed.
All right, let's talk about your top-down fitting technique. So what are some of the issues and problems a good bike fit will resolve? We'll start with that, and then we'll figure out how you do it.
Well, a good bike fit, from my point of view, is corrective. I'm not a big fan of accommodated bike fits.
What does that mean?
Accommodated bike fits means you're not going to improve. You're basically freezing you in time and setting up the bike around you.
Okay.
Which is the classic way of bike fitting.
Sure.
We start off with a musculoskeletal exam done by a trainer or a therapist specifically oriented towards cycling. So we find out what your strengths are, what your weaknesses are, range of motion, where you're strong, where you're not, where your history of injury is, so that I have a much better model to start with in a bike fit. I have a 7-page questionnaire that covers everything from head trauma to pregnancy. I want to know your whole history, including your cycling history. I want to know when you learned to shift. Did you learn to shift on down tube shifters? Did you learn to shift on index shifters or non-index shifters? I want to know how you ride. I want to know what you're doing. In essence, I want to know everything. And that's how we start a bike fit.
All right. Before we move on, I want to let listeners know again that we're speaking with Happy Friedman. He is a professional bike fitter out of the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York City. What are you able to do for people who have, as we age, people are getting hip replacements, knee replacements, shoulder, wrist. What can you do for those people?
Let's start with the hip replacement.
Okay, good.
What's the biggest issue with a cyclist with a hip replacement? It's getting on the bike. Being able to swing that leg over the saddle. That's the first major hurdle that you've got to overcome.
Right.
So my repertoire does not necessarily say conventional 10-speed. I might look at a Moulton or a Friday, depending on their needs. I might look at a Brompton. There are many tools to consider when you're looking at a patient who wants to get back on a bike. And the goal is to get them back on a bike.
What about a step through?
Well, those are all bikes that are low standover heights.
Right, right. Or sloping top.
Or sloping top. Or what we used to call a women's frame or a mixie. We look at their capacities and then we figure out where to go from there. I'm not pre-assuming anything when they show up. And for most fitters, they think they're fitting for road bikes, tri bikes, or mountain bikes. The other stuff is kind of, that's not serious. But my attitude is it's the cyclist who you have to be serious about, not the bikes.
Right. So who comes to you for fittings? Let's get that person in there first, because what I'm hearing is I know you deal with young, very fit athletes, but you also are dealing with another part of our population, which I think is becoming more important in some ways.
I'm dealing with people who need help. I do everything from pediatrics to geriatrics. So I'll see an older population that's more affluent sometimes or less affluent, but they want to ride. And so the goal is to find a way to get them on a bike.
What do you do with pediatrics?
We have kids with disabilities. Ah. So they want to learn to ride a bike. We have to figure out how to adapt a bike to meet their needs. It could be anything from dwarfism to anything. So it's a creative process for me to meet their needs. There are no assumptions made.
What's the most overlooked problem in bike fit?
The cyclist. No,
I know. I'm only laughing because I totally agree. It's like we're looking at the bike, we're forgetting that there's a person there, and the person is the most important thing.
Yeah.
Sure.
You know, many fitters treat people based on the bike they show up with. Or the worst end is they treat people based on their experience as a fitter and cyclist, not as the needs of the person riding a bike. You can sit and look in Central Park on a Saturday afternoon, watch thousands of bikes go by, and in some cases you know exactly who did the fit by looking at how the bike was set up.
Interesting. I never thought of that.
It's getting beyond your own personal biases when you're fitting, and that can be a major issue.
All right, let's say I come in for a bike fit. What is your process? Where, besides the 7-page questionnaire?
We start with the exam while I'm logging your bike. I am not going to do the exam. I know how to do it. I've done thousands, but I have people who are much better at it than I am and much more efficient and quicker and able to get the points that in 30 minutes that would take me an hour and a half to find. The other thing I've learned is my attention span, actually it's not my attention span, it's my client's attention span, is limited. You get to do quality work for about 90 minutes before somebody's head nods back and they lose your attention. So we do a fit in about 2 to 2.5 hours.
Yeah, it's a long time.
The first part is done as an exam. I'm watching, I'm listening, and I'm inputting, asking questions, but it's not my time. It's the therapist or the trainer's time. Your focus is on them, not on me. at a certain point, you get bored with me. You get bored with anybody. I try not to monopolize the beginning and learn as much as I can through somebody else's work, and then I start to fit. Our conversation is now fresh, and I get my hour to hour and a half of total attention from you and you from me. This way, we're able to communicate better. I'm able to teach you things that will be helpful in your riding. And to me, a bike fit is a teaching experience as well as a learning experience. It's not just, well, you need these handlebars, you need these pedals. To me, it's how are we sitting? How are we breathing? How are we supporting our torso? What muscles are we using? What muscles are we not using? Why are we not using them? Can you diaphragmatically breathe? Do you have TMJ? These are all little things that affect how you breathe on a bike. And then we start worrying about how you sit on a bike. And how you sit on a bike is a big issue. Nobody teaches us to do that. We have wonderful tools for measuring how wide a saddle you might need. But I don't know about you, but I don't sit on my ischial tuberosities, which are what most tools measure the width of. So we have to figure out where you're actually sitting on your saddle, not where the ischials are, because they're not on the saddle. You may have a guy in a shop measure you and say, oh, you need a 16-centimeter saddle. That's nice, but I'm used to be an aggressive rider. I tend to ride with my pelvis tilted slightly forward, which means I have a narrower portion of my body meeting the saddle. So you have to listen, look, see, to figure out what you're going to do during a bike fit.
Let me remind our listeners once again, we're speaking with Happy Friedman. He is a professional bike fitter in New York City. One of the things that I know and what I do, and I think maybe you do this too, and that is you don't try to change somebody's 40-year-old habits overnight. So that, for example, somebody who's always thrown a knee out when they pedal, suddenly you change the position of their cleats. Now they have knee problems.
Actually, I don't even start changing the cleats.
Okay.
I'm starting from the top. I'm not touching the cleats. If there's a tracking error in the knees, I'm going to look and see if it's coming from the pelvis. Is there an absence of stability? Is there a torn labrum? We have lots of choices. So if I started at the bottom, I'm going to stick a shim or a wedge somewhere or put an insole or an orthotic in a shoe that's going to push everything out of alignment, going up the line to get something into alignment. I'm trying to take a minimalist, least invasive approach to getting my corrections.
Do you ever find somebody who walks in and the fit is perfect? It's great?
I had a woman come in yesterday with a brand new bike she bought in the bike store. And I didn't have to touch anything. Her cleats were fine. The seat height was fine. And that's a tricky issue.
Yeah.
Which I'll come back to.
Okay.
Everything there was just as I didn't touch. But we spent 2 hours of solid work changing her posture, her breathing technique, how she sat on the bike, all that, where the weight went, where it didn't, how to transfer weight from front end to back end, and why you want to be able to transfer it. Basically, I unlocked her saddle position. She had rode sitting plopped down on the saddle from habit and from what everybody had been telling me, just sit down and pedal. And as our conversation evolved, I learned she was getting gapped when she was riding with a group, and it wasn't even a competitive group. So we figured out that her back end would be light as she would come around the corner, and she'd have to hit her brakes and slow down and then accelerate to catch back up with the group. So what we looked at is where she sat on the bike, and she had too much weight on the front end. I taught her how to shift weight from the front end to the back wheel as you go through a turn so that she could keep traction and stay on the wheel with the person in front of her. That's part of a bike fit. You're trying to give them tools to do what they need to do when they ride.
So it's more of a skill lesson, too. You're teaching skills.
Absolutely.
Which is, I think, very lacking in most instances. I don't think a lot of people focus on skills and handling. Evidently, it detracts a lot from fit.
If you're not teaching, then why are they there?
Yeah, right.
You're supporting bad habits.
That's true.
I don't like supporting bad habits. I like to, well, I look at it this way. Everybody growing up learns how to pedal a bike. As a little kid, we start with a trike. We learn to make the wheel go round and round and round. Nobody teaches us how to make the bike go in a straight line, how to take a corner, how to carve a corner if you've got a lot of speed, how to bunny hop if you need to get over something. These are all things that you learn if you take up mountain biking, if you take up road racing, when we view them as part of a racer's skill set. But they're not. They're part of everybody's skill set. You need to learn this to survive in traffic. So I'm trying to make you into an efficient rider. It's, you know, rather than just saying, we're going to make the bike do all the work, you're the motor. I want to make you efficient.
Well, you started to talk a little bit about seat height, which is always a dicey subject.
Well, let's start with a couple of premises.
Okay.
Your height is not consistent. Your arch height varies by as much as 1.5 centimeters over the course of a day. Your total height can vary by as much as 4.5 centimeters over the course of a day. Seat height, from my point of view, is variable, but it's really not. Your body's variable. What I look at the body is a series of mobile adapters. Mobile adapters to me are joints that move in more than one direction. Your ankle, your hip, your shoulder, your elbow, your wrist, so that you can adapt your position as your height varies during the day. If we start in the morning, you're taller. Generally, if we at the end of the day, you're shorter. So if I'm picking a seat height, I'm picking something that is going to cover the full range, somewhere in what I think is the middle of your range. There's an experiment you can do, and I sometimes ask people who have saddle issues to do before they come in. Measure your height in the morning, measure your height in the evening, and do this for 4 or 5 days before you come to me so that we can see the deviation that you produce so we can get a better idea of where we want you as we design a cockpit for your bike.
When do you want to see the person, early or late?
I want to see you when you can come to me.
Okay. That's a good answer.
The answer is, when do you ride your bike? And I'm saying this kind of satirically. You know, I should fit, if you're riding at 9 o'clock, you need to see me for a 9 o'clock fit. But that's not practical. But you need to understand that things change and people change. Not over weeks, months, or years, but hours. I get a kick out of it when a triathlete comes into me and complains that somebody moved their seat 2 millimeters. And I'm like, okay, but we've got 4 centimeters of height variability. And you're complaining about 2 millimeters of saddle. There's something wrong with this picture.
How long does it take to get an appointment with you?
Since I share the space with other practitioners, we try to get you within 10 days to 2 weeks. Sometimes it's a little longer, sometimes it's a little less, but in season, we're about 10 days to 2 weeks.
Do people come from all over?
I've had people come in from Europe. I have people from the West Coast. I've had people from Canada, all coming in for a specific fit. I actually had at one point a group from Ohio, which is your stomping ground, and they were coming east because of word of mouth in a club that I wasn't doing what they were getting in their bike shops.
So if you were to give somebody one piece of advice before they actually come to you to make a change or to adjust their thinking, what would it be?
The best advice I can give you is come in without any preconceived notions of what you want, but come in with a list of things you'd like to accomplish. How I'm going to get you there may not be the way you think you're going to get there. I had a guy come in. He had found a deal on a tri bike. He was saving $5,000. He had a buddy, and he was miserable on the bike. Well, the bike didn't fit him. The top tube was too long. He was too stretched out. The front end was too low. He wasn't strong enough to hold it. And I told him, I can make the bike rideable, but you're not going to be happy because it's not going to look like the hot bike that you'd seen on the cover of a magazine, which motivated you to buy it in the first place.
That's so interesting. I know exactly what you're talking about. People's ideas of, I want to be lower in front. I want my saddle higher. I want to be back farther. And then they find out they are not comfortable, efficient. They're in pain and they don't understand it. Why don't I look like that guy on the cover of the magazine? That is exactly right. It's so interesting to hear you say that.
But we can go to the cover of the magazine. We can go to coverage of the tour. Just because you're a pro doesn't mean you're going to get a good fit. And just because you've got a hot bike doesn't mean you're anywhere near efficient. Do you remember a few years ago, Talansky crashed and had the back injury?
Yes.
They never touched his bike. They kept the bars down low. Everything was still in what they considered race form. As a former coach and a fitter, the first thing we would have done is put a stem that comes up to him on the bike. I might have refitted the bars as well so that his back would relax. It would be easier for him to breathe, and I think he could have been kept in the race until things calmed down. But that's not how they treated him. The bike is the bike, and they left it.
Forgetting that the rider is what makes the bike happen to begin with. So that's
exactly.
Really, well, how can people find out more about your work, Happy? Tell them where to go to look.
Well, if you Google me, Happy Friedman, and it's F-R-E-E-D-M-A-N, you'll find there's a number of articles out there. And if you want me in person, you can contact the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York City at 212-606-1000. That's the general number. They'll find me. The number for the lab directly is 212-606-1520, I believe. I'll confirm that with you.
Okay. Well, we'll put it up on our site. And someday I'll get to New York. I would love to just see your lab and just see what you're doing and watch it. I mean, you know, we have very rudimentary tools comparatively in our shop, but our technique is pretty much what you're saying. And so it is all about the person on the bike.
Well, the toolbox that counts is the toolbox that's in the fitter's head.
Yes.
It's understanding what the bike is capable of, understanding what the rider is capable of, and trying to solidify the relationship between the two of them.
So I have a question that didn't occur to me till right now that I don't want to gloss over, because as fitters like you and me and other professional fitters get older and decide, okay, I'm done doing this, do you think it's something you can teach?
I do teach it.
Oh, you do? Okay.
I have an open door policy in the lab. I've invited every fitter in the greater New York area to come in and sit in on my fits. The only way to learn is to observe and to fit and then to get critiqued. And I have invited, for example, Ben Serrata.
Sure.
To come critique my fitting. You can't get better without somebody watching. Unfortunately, most of the fit schools in this country today critique you on your paperwork, not on your actual fitting skills.
Do you think there's an art to it as well as a science?
There's an art to communication, which I think is the art that is missing from bike fitting. Technical skills are easy. Understanding what somebody really wants and needs is hard. But I also think there are a lot of hand skills in fitting that people don't have. How to palpate a joint, how to get somebody to cue off your contact as to where they should bend. These are skills that we're not teaching in fitting. You need to know how to touch a person properly, appropriately, and to give direction.
Yeah, that's something that you learn as a yoga instructor, how to give good direction in how to move, how to place yourself, you know, where to put your hands, where to put your feet. That, so yeah, I understand that. That translates really well.
You know, what we're talking about is movement. I mean, one of the things I do when I'm doing a bike fit is I ask people to stand up straight and close their eyes and just stand there for about a minute, minute and a half. Not everybody can do that to start off with. But that's basically the basics of what the police call a Romberg, which is a drunk test. But I'm looking to see where the loading goes, where they're carrying their body. Do they shift from left to right, right to left? It tells me what muscle groups they depend on. Do they shift their feet, which tells me what's going to happen on pedals instinctively when they want to get more power. Some people will rotate in. Some people will rotate out. Some people are just kind of reaching to find a place to get power. This will show up in a Romberg. At least point you in the right direction. So my toolbox, as much as all the toys I have, is my toolbox, is really not the tools I rely on. It's understanding the anatomy I'm dealing with. It's understanding how people are applying it, corrections that they make, how they breathe. Those are the tools that make a good fitter.
Well, on that note, I'd like to say thank you for talking with me today. And again, we've been speaking with Happy Friedman. He is a professional bike fitter at the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York City. We will post the information on how to get in touch with him. There's some great articles that he's written, and we will post those also. Happy, I hope you have a wonderful spring and summer, and maybe we're going to finally see some warm weather, huh?
Oh, I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks so much for talking with me.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
All right. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye. Happy Friedman joined me from the Leon Root MD Motion Analysis Lab at the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York City. If you're interested in knowing more about Happy's work, you can go to www.hss.edu/rehab-motion-analysis-lab. Or for an appointment with Happy, you can call Steve Bartolini, who schedules all of Happy's appointments at 212-606-1215. So that's our show for this week. I hope you enjoyed it. My thanks to Joe Lindsay, Larry Peasy, and Happy Friedman for joining me. Remember that you can always join our conversation on our Facebook page. You can send us a tweet at Outspoken Cyclist without an E, or leave a comment on our blog at OutspokenCyclist.com. The Outspoken Cyclist is a listener-sponsored podcast, and I'd like to thank all of you who have so generously supported the show. If you are interested in offering your support, you can log on to OutspokenCyclist.com and click the donate button. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with a brand new edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. We have longer days and warmer temperatures, so I hope you get a chance to go for a ride and stay safe out there. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.